to the outside's influence of just 12 social media accounts in manipulating attitudes towards the pandemic. New information has come to light about the magnitude of disinformation fueling the COVID-19 and mandate protests in Parliament this summer, culminating in driving three quarters of fake news chatter on Parliament's protest final day. A new report from Te Pūnaha Matatini's Disinformation Project has found never before seen popularity of misinformation, disinformation and extremist thought. The amount of traffic on Facebook misinformation pages was at one point higher than that of pages operated by New Zealand mainstream media outlets combined. On one single day, March 2nd, they received 350,000 interactions compared to 247,000 for all of the mainstream media sites combined. Posts on one single Facebook page, run by a known, quote, misinformation superspreader the researchers haven't named, drew on some of the highest engagement of all public pages in the country over the protest period. The project has closely tracked mis- and disinformation activity on social media before and during the event, discovering that its spread, speed and size has grown steadily since November. Kate Hanna from Te Pūnaha Matatini's Disinformation Project, Te Nākwe and welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine.
How did you do this?
How did we do this? So we've been observing disinformation in the New Zealand ecosystem since the beginning of the pandemic. And we do it in a mixed quantitative and qualitative methodology. So we gather quantitative data and using computational methods. All of the data is open source. And for those mainstream social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter, it's gathered using CrowdTangle, which is a Facebook-built tool for studying Facebook pages and groups. And then we also have a rich text approach, so we analyse the content of some of those open posts and also the content of things like flyers, billboards, placards and signs, WhatsApp messages and emails that sometimes members of the public send us as examples of misinformation that they've received or people they love have received. And that kind of combination means we get this really grounded and situated Aotearoa New Zealand specific ecosystem to study instead of just looking online.
That said, you've got very specific numbers here, range of panels, the more mainstream like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, but then there are others that are often much more interesting in content in inverted commas, Telegram, Rumble, Odyssey, Gab and Getter. Did you actually get on those open source sites yourselves as well, or were you able to extract numbers from those as well?
So we extracted data from any open platforms in those sub-platforms. So it's this with Telegram in an open channel. You can download data from an open channel and review it. Yeah.
Okay. Were you surprised by the extent of the influence or the extent of the interaction with these sites relative to mainstream media over this time? It was obviously a very intensive period. It was a time of high activity by those who were protesting or were at the site or were interested in that. But were you surprised by the skew on some days between major mainstream media sites and these handful of channels?
To a certain extent, we weren't surprised because it's what we had been starting to observe over the period since August 2021. But at the same time, the level of change and engagement, you know, that March 2nd, you know, significantly more engagement with what we would call disinformation channels as opposed to mainstream media channels. I mean, the whole country was incredibly interested in what was taking place at Parliament. And so many people were watching live streams, obviously from mainstream media platforms like Radio New Zealand or, you know, the television stations to understand what was taking place. But what is so interesting and quite remarkable and something we need to sort of think about going forward is how so many people were getting their information from places that were completely grounded in a different interpretation and a different reality of what was going on.
This wasn't just curiosity. This was a whole literally different universe from what other people were experiencing. And can you explain a little bit more about that? How there were sort of parallel realities of what was unfolding, please?
Yes, so I guess with the parliamentary protest and occupation, we saw, not for the first time, but for the first extended period of time, online communities manifesting as offline communities. And so the experience of the people who were on the ground at Parliament and those that they were communicating with who either wanted to be there or maybe had been there but had returned home, because there was a lot of movement over that period of 23 days, was markedly different from the experience of those of us who were observing what was going on, both online and offline. And so we get this splintered reality where people genuinely felt connected, supported, they were being fed, they were being looked after, they were being told that their own sense of loss or personal grievance had a political or social importance that connected into a bigger picture. Meanwhile, the rest of us were observing from the outside, seeing violence, death threats, harassment of school children, people who lived in apartments nearby feeling very unsafe, sort of dirt and destruction. You know, so there were very different experiences, both offline and online, over quite an extended period of time. 23 days is quite a long time. And so that significantly separated lived experience for a group of New Zealanders.
Lived experience, but when it came to false information and some of the more extreme conspiracy theories surrounding even the events that were unfolding at the time at Parliament, could you explain more about the source and spread of that information?
So we have been seeing increasing amounts of US-based style content coming through into the New Zealand information ecosystem since the American elections in 2020. Another key spike around the period of the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. And then again throughout 2021, because the US experienced lockdowns, mask mandates, vaccination ahead of New Zealand, there were pre-packaged sets of disinformation about those issues that linked those issues to a conspiracy around the role of the state. And those pre-packaged conspiracies were transferred into the New Zealand environment almost intact. And so by the time we went into level 4 lockdown in August 2021, that material had become really quite embedded within a small community. And then over the period of that lockdown, as people were feeling more alone, more disconnected, more unsure about their future, more concerned about the decision that they needed to make about vaccination or vaccination for their children, it became more and more confirmed in their mind, the sort of confirmation bias. And so the people who were communicating this became confirmed in their mind as valid and truthful and genuine sources they could rely on.
Give an example. I think when the paediatric vaccine rollout kicked out, there was one post claiming children had collapsed, and I remember this one specifically, actually, at a vaccination centre. And could you use that as one example of how first that idea even became a thing, and then second, yeah, how it spread?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good example. So over the period, even prior to the announcement of the COVID-19 vaccine, groups in New Zealand and internationally were talking about the dangers of a new vaccine. So they were preceding the idea that the vaccine would be dangerous. They were also preceding ideas around children and dangers to children. Now, obviously, in terms of creating a sense of fear and violence, when people perceive that there's a threat to children, that's a really strong emotional response to then react. You know, a violent reaction if someone's threatening children is almost appropriate, right? You know, it becomes self-confirming. And so the communities had been told that the vaccine would be dangerous and that it would be particularly dangerous for children. And so by the time the vaccine rolled out to Tamariki was announced, there was a wellspring of diverse information across the information ecosystem that said that children would be harmed and had examples of harm for children internationally. So then when that false story was circulated, and then circulated in the initial instance by quite a trusted interlocutor, somebody who has had experience as a broadcast journalist and as a familiar face to New Zealanders, no matter the fact-checking that took place of that particular piece of false information, that has never resonated in that community. It's a signal of a completely splintered reality.
Let's look at the sources again of this information, disinformation, right? It's an extraordinary coincidence that you've identified 12 online social media accounts being responsible for the vast proportion of it. There's the internationally known disinformation dozen, as it's referred to, refers to another 12 sites that have anti-vaccination specifically, I think, that have been tracked to be responsible for the vast majority of the anti-vaccine information that is globally being spread. I don't know whether there's some kind of statistical relevance to that, but could you tell me a little bit more about how you were able to place much of the source of so much of the content back to just 12 social media accounts?
I guess they're not specifically individual accounts. They're more like 12 clusters, so groups and related individuals in some cases, and in some cases they're individual accounts. And usually those clusters have multiple presences on multiple social media platforms. What we have not yet explored, but what I'm interested in exploring, is an idea around that kind of number of 12 to 14, providing for a community, a society, enough variation in the kind of mode in which disinformation is shared to kind of appeal to all the different types of audiences. You know, so you have people who are very professional and very polished and sort of have very organised, some who have kind of Christian messages packaged around what they're doing, some who are more kind of fringy and more YouTube-like or more like that kind of Fox News style. And so that kind of provides a variety so that each person who's going and looking at the stuff will find a location that speaks to them.
It's like a critical mass and a sufficient critical mass for information to go viral. Would that be one way of putting it?
Yeah, and also a sufficient critical mass for them to cross-share across each other's platforms and accounts so that individuals and group who are looking at these different groups and accounts, you know, see a cohesive narrative across what looks like a number of different platforms.
It reinforces, and this comes back to the human psychology of all this. This isn't them and us. This is human beings and our psychology, the way we receive information, the way we process information, the way we accept or reject it, and we're all the same, pretty much, in how that, framework works. And you've mentioned it, confirmation bias, group identity, peer pressure, just even the state of mind we're in at the time, the sense of well-being or otherwise we have at the time, correct?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but we definitely see that, for one of the things we noticed straight away in August and September was that the circadian rhythm of disinformation production and consumption changed really quite swiftly. So people were producing and sharing disinformation at longer periods of the day, and people were consuming and engaging with that disinformation for longer periods of the day. So that's instantly a signal that people are staying up later, getting up earlier and spending more time online, you know, all of which is not contributing to their well-being.
What are the implications? We're going into an election year next year. We're just coming out of a pandemic. We're heading probably towards an economic recession or close to, all these pressures. There's a war that's causing, you know, particular concern because of the ramifications that could spiral into something major. These are febrile times. And they're occurring now in a new information age and in the social media age and the speed at which information fairly accurate or fairly inaccurate.
Yeah.
Moves very, very quickly. What are the implications?
Well, there's really significant implications, you know, as you've described, Catherine, for Aotearoa and globally. And, you know, the key concern for us at the Disinformation Project is the way in which dividedness is being promoted. You know, the idea that we're divided as a country is being promoted. There's a sense of antagonism that's been encouraged. And it's not just from disinformation producers. I mean, obviously, people who participate in looking at mainstream media do feel upset and let down by you know, family members and other people who have participated in disinformation. So there's this kind of constructed antagonism, which, if left unchecked, will continue to sort of play off each other and result in impacts on our, you know, election cycles, etc. One of the really critical things that we didn't discuss deeply in the paper, but is mentioned, is the language of violence and misogyny that has become normalised in the disinformation sphere and is now creeping back through into normal socio-political discourse. And that is likely to have chilling effects on the participation of diverse peoples in electoral moments. And that, you know, obviously is a really key concern. So what we're thinking about is, as we return to those places that are not online, our workplaces, our schools, our concerts, our rugby fields, our netball courts, all of those places that we are in community with people who are not exactly the same as us, who don't necessarily share the same political or religious beliefs or whatever, but who we do know we share values with, is to actually talk about those shared values. We need to collectively stand up and start talking about some sort of things that maybe New Zealanders get a bit embarrassed about talking about. But, you know, what makes us a transparent social democracy? What are the things that are shared? What do we celebrate? You know, and I think that sounds quite Pollyanna-ish, but it's actually really important. This is not something that a government can do or governments should do. And it's not something that we can rely on platforms or international law to manage. We actually have to take hold of this as Aotearoa New Zealand.
Kate, thank you. Kate Hanna from Te Punaha Matatini's Disinformation Project on that just released and fascinating report, the crunching they've done of the sharing of misinformation online and its extraordinary explosion around the time of the parliamentary protests, although it had been rising throughout the pandemic.